Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Steve Zwemke. For the last 17 years, our next guest has lived and worked in Tehran. As the New York Times Tehran Bureau Chief, Thomas Erdbrink is one of just a few Western reporters allowed to work in Iran. Tonight is the first of a two-night frontline series called Our Man in Tehran, in which Erdbrink opens the front door to an Iran you may not know. He shares encounters inside the closed society of Iran and visits with the country's people about the challenges of living under theocratic leadership. You can see Our Man in Tehran, Part 1, tonight at 8 Central, with Part 2 airing tomorrow night at 8 Central on SDPB-TV. Right now, we welcome Thomas Erdbrink as he joins us live from Tehran by Skype. Mr. Erdbrink, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Very good. It's great to have you with us today. Let's go ahead and start right at the beginning here. Chapter 1, Once Upon a Time, I Met a Girl. It's such an important part of Our Man in Tehran. Let's start there.
Well, that's where I actually meet my future wife and where I introduce my family in law and where I show what life is like for me here in Iran. And the reason I'm doing that, Steve, is because when you're a reporter for the New York Times reporting from Iran, you talk a lot about sanctions and the nuclear program and, you know, even the threat of war. But you rarely talk about daily life. And that's exactly the question I get from a lot of people after I've given like this big puffy lecture on subjects like that. Then they come up to me and they say like, hey, what is life like for you over there? And that's why we started out with a personal part, which we started out with the story of how I met my wife during an eclipse in 1999.
Yeah. I had no idea what to expect when I began watching Our Man in Tehran. And as you already said, if your goal is to offer up a slice of life of not only you, but the Iranian people, the film is definitely a great success. You've had friends and colleagues jailed. You've seen and felt the strict rule of the Iranian government. How do you think you've managed to work in the country for so long and remain as one of the few foreign journalists still allowed to work there?
I think that is a very valid question. And when I started out here, when I really moved to Tehran in 2001, there were dozens of foreign reporters here. Then, of course, the Iraq war happened. So a lot of people, they shifted from Iran to Iraq. And also foreign journalism was having a hard time in those years. So a lot of people left. Then there were big protests here in Tehran in 2009. And after those protests, the BBC correspondent was expelled. Reuters was expelled. I was working for the Washington Post at the time. I kept on reporting, but I wasn't expelled. And I guess from that point on, Steve, it's just been patience and perseverance. I have problems here, as you might imagine. Not everybody agrees with what I write. Not everybody agrees with this documentary. But I just hung in there and I remained.
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads me into the next question. Reporting for the New York Times is one thing, but I'm really wondering how you were able to get permission to film in Iran for the Our Man in Tehran documentary.
Well, we look at Iran as this really closed and isolated and mysterious country, and in many ways it is. But at the same time, time hasn't stood still here either. Just like in South Dakota, you know, I can imagine, you know, life has changed because of the internet, because of satellite TV, because of cheap travel. I mean, our world is so much smaller now. And I think that that in Iran, the same thing has happened. People have changed. The government has changed a little bit. And as I said, a lot of people in the government, they weren't too happy with every subject in this documentary. But at the same time, they objected, but they gave me a permit to make a second film. And the result is airing tonight and tomorrow on PBS Frontline. So they showed tolerance that a lot of people don't expect from them. And in this case, I managed to take advantage of that and to be allowed to do this.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the internet, and I want to get to that in just a little bit. But first of all, describe the Friday prayers and the significance of them since the 1979 revolution, which ushered in the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Yeah, well, I think the Friday prayers those are the images we all know from Iran. Mm-hmm. Angry people who fist pump and shout death to America and other terrible things. And these Friday prayers, they take place every Friday in 700 locations in this country. At the same time, what we usually don't report is that at these Friday prayers, only a fraction of the people is actually there. In Tehran, which is a city of 12 million, there are maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people at the Friday prayers. Now, I decided in the film to follow a man who loves to go to these Friday prayers, who loves to say death to America, and I ask him why you do this kind of things. And the answer is that he says, because it gives him energy. And he also says that if the supreme leader of Iran would tell him not to shout death to America, he would immediately stop doing it. So I felt it's important to see this kind of people from up close and see what threat they represent.
Yeah. Big Mouth is what he's called, correct?
Yes. And yeah. if when you see the images, you will know why.
Right. No, that sort of leads me back to the question about the internet, because in your conversation with this man, he blames the internet in part for scapegoating America, if you will. My question is, how has the internet changed Iran?
I think that that this was a country where on the streets, you would have to adhere to the rules of the leaders. And those rules are that you have to wear an Islamic scarf, that you have to stick to certain rules, that men and women are partly segregated. But the internet, and then at the same time, sorry, Iran's leaders would say, but at home you can do whatever you like, as long as we don't see it. Well, the internet has changed all that, because if I have a party in my house, and for instance, there are, you know, things taking, like dancing is taking place, then I could take a picture of that, post it to Instagram, where everybody's on nowadays in Iran, and what is private suddenly becomes public. And this has really changed the country beyond belief, up to the point that now even the supreme leader has an Instagram account. Of course, he is not posting any private pictures, but a lot of normal people have Instagram accounts, and they post pictures of themselves. Just go on your Instagram and type Iran. You can see for yourself.
How closely does the government keep tabs on its citizens in Iran?
Well, a lot less than before. A lot of people would think of Eastern Germany, where the government is involved in every aspect of society. But if you're actually here in Iran, and what you also see in the two films, is that people really try to live around the rules they don't like. There's also people who like the rules, but the people who don't like the rules, they try to live around them. So, for instance, we follow a woman who is divorced and wants to find a house for herself. Mm-hmm. But according to some rules, you're not allowed to live by yourself as a single younger woman. So she actually explains how tough this was for her. Or we follow a woman who doesn't agree with the obligatory headscarf, the Islamic veil. She goes on the street and she protests by taking off the veil. So you can see either very openly or sort of more in a practical manner, people are trying to live around those rules, and the state is actually tolerating a lot of that.
Yeah. Thomas Erdbrink is our guest right now. He is the Tehran bureau chief for the New York Times, and he's joining us live from Tehran right now. Thomas, what do you enjoy about your life in Tehran?
Well, oddly enough, this is a country where if we think of Iran, we think of all these angry fist-pumping people, but where actually a lot of very nice people live. And Iranians have a great sense of humor. I like to talk to people. I'm a reporter. So when I go on the street here, people really talk to me. They make all sorts of jokes, all sorts of remarks, critical remarks, funny remarks. They are incredibly hospitable and friendly people. And this is really what is so starkly different from the image that we have of this country. And that is also something that I try to bring across in the films.
Yeah. That being said, it sounds like Tehran has kept up with infrastructure, modern facilities, shopping and dining experiences, things like that. How does Tehran rate as a metropolitan area?
Well, that's a good question. It's a metropolitan area, but always with a twist, because you have everything here, and you can go to the best restaurant with the best food, but you can't order a bottle of wine, of course. So that's where things stop. You can go to the cinema, and the cinema will look just like an American cinema complex. Many big cinemas, parking lots, everything, popcorn. But then there are very few foreign movies. So and at the same time, you can get all those foreign movies on DVD on the laid out by street vendors next to the cinema, even though they're illegal. So there are all these complex rules that make life very complex and that you have to live around.
As a journalist, what's the most dangerous situation you've encountered during your time in Tehran?
Well, I've been arrested, during demonstrations. Mm-hmm. Certain people have told me not to write things in a certain manner over the years. But at the same time, yeah, I managed to live and work here and write all the stories I want to that are published on the front page. So, yes, I face problems, just like reporters in Russia and China face problems nowadays. It's been pretty okay. But for instance, for my colleague Jason Reza Young from the Washington Post, who was arrested for over a year, these things were very different. And those are things that happen in this country.
What eventually got him out of jail?
He was part of a prison exchange that was a part of the nuclear agreement that the Obama administration struck with Europe, China, and Russia and Iran. So a day after that agreement was signed, as a side letter, Jason and four other dual national Americans and one full-on American were released in the prison exchange, and America released, I think, 8 Iranian-American prisoners.
Can Iran change, and by that I mean, can it be more open to the rest of the world?
I definitely think it can, and I definitely think that Iran has tried to be more open to the world in the run-up and right after the nuclear agreement of 2015. But if it really can change, if it can shed parts of its ideology, that will really be up to the Iranian leaders and the Iranian people. And it's just very hard for me to see how that will develop. What is really clear is that Iranian society has really modernized, not only the capital, but also other cities. 70% of Iranians live in cities. This is a very urban country. People have certain demands. Iran's leaders are not always inflexible on everything, but ultimately it's up to them and the people to see where this is going, and it will be very interesting to see.
Thomas Erdbrink, we have run out of time, but I thank you much for joining us. Thomas Erdbrink, featured in Our Man in Tehran, the first of a two-part series, tonight at 8 o'clock on SDPB-TV. Thomas, thank you. Best to you and to Nusha.
Thank you. Great being on your show, Steve. Thank you very much.